And how could there be such a thing as police in a world so fragile and lighted by need? You have to say peace each time that you leave. Mourn it or don't, absence runs the streets. Oh, the past does swagger through avenues of last things, but the fact of the lack of you shadows few dice games. It's a strange debt we forget, only warrants in the wind. To rep a set at all is strange debt, to forget once again. The second act of cruise can loosen from first theme, when crew is just them and you uniquely incomplete. There are two things in life that you cannot trust in. One, the wind, and then all whom its fingers skim. On the wrong side of dawn, did you pause, then fall off? Oh, John, has your lover left for rehab or the cloth? And it's a strange debt. They are warrants in the wind. To give a fuck at all is strange debt to be collected once again. It is truly difficult to cross a pair of bad legs, for between Newport drags, nothing rhymes with death. Do you remember when you confronted the sun? Does only Eli Lilly know the dirt that you've done? Yes, we have returned to avenues of first things, and we're back to burn the debris of beginnings.
Oh, yeah. Welcome to the motherfucking Soulcast. Happy motherfucking New Year. Same shit. And as the wise folks say, 2017 is not yet done with us. Today's guest is the Pedestrian. Pedestrian is, you know, probably my all-time best friend, and in many ways a mentor in so many ways. I met Pedestrian in 1993. We were trading tapes online and became friends. He heard my music and was like, you know what, you need to hear some West Coast shit. And to me, West Coast music was G-Funk and Snoop Dogg and gangster rap. And he put me up on Project Blowed, Freestyle Fellowship, and all this West Coast underground shit that just blew open my mind about what hip-hop could be. After that, you know, he moved around the country and eventually ended up moving to Portland, Maine and living with J.D. Walker. And, you know, throughout all those times, we've, you know, this is a long time ago. This is, you know, 24 years ago. And, you know, at one point we just decided, hey, let's move to the Bay. Let's start a record label. And we hopped on a Greyhound bus. And we went out west, and him and I started a record company called Anticon. Of all the people involved with that project, he really was like the ideological sort of, you know, I don't know, visionary behind it. He came up with the name, came up with the idea of having a collectively run record label, and really always pushed hard on aesthetics. You know, the irony here is that he doesn't give a fuck about, you know, being a rapper, about having a music career. And so this conversation is just really dope, because people who've been listening to him all these years, they don't know this kind of shit about him. Hold on, let me wait for this chorus to end. Yeah. jobs. Okay. So anyway, what I was saying is that, you know, Pedestrian doesn't do interviews. He doesn't have a Facebook page. He doesn't give a fuck, because he knows that this shit is, at the end, it's empty. And so from there, he went on to kind of pursue an academic career and, you know, saw the limitations of that. But we're just going to have a really, really dope. I mean, this guy is like one of the smartest people I've ever known in my life. He's fucking brilliant. And it was an honor for him to ask me to put out his new album on my record label, Black Box Tapes. If you want to check it out, go to blackboxtapes.bandcamp.com and check out the Pedestrian Un-Indian album. It's fucking amazing. I mean, he's got beats on there from Jail, Odd Nostom, Paper Bark. And yeah, so this conversation, we're going to just kind of talk about identity, about California, about race, you know, talk a little bit about Anticon. I almost deleted all the Anticon shit, but then I was like, you know what? People need to hear this shit. So I could say a lot more, but, you know, just let the interview play. And if you dig what he has to say, go pick up his album. And as usual, before we start this interview, we're going to hear from someone else from the Channel Zero Podcast Network. And for more information on the Channel Zero Podcast Network, go to channelzeronetwork.com. And if you enjoy this podcast and you want to support it and help me grow it, go to patreon.com/SOLEONE, or you can go to soulone.org, SOLEONE.org. /support, and you can throw me some Bitcoin or fucking Ruples or whatever the fuck, Ripples, or I don't fucking, shit's fucking worthless anyway.
Join us for Kiteline, a weekly radio program on Channel Zero Network that focuses on issues in the prison system. With over 50 episodes already released, you can hear informative and riveting stories about the impact of prisons on people both inside and outside of the prison walls, and how they fight back.
Kiteline is intended as means of communication between people across prison walls. Our goal at Kiteline is to amplify the voices of those within the prison system while encouraging dialogue with those on the outside.
Hear us on the Channel Zero Network and visit our website for more information or previous episodes at kitelineradio.noblogs.org.
So, Brandon, a.k.a. The Pedestrian, welcome to the fucking Soulcast, dude.
What's up, man?
You know... just hanging out here in Denver, you know, it's another 80-degree winter day, you know?
Uh-huh, nuclear winter.
Yeah. You got a little nuclear winter going on over in L.A., huh?
Yeah, we're aflame. Yeah, this is, like, the thing about L.A. is that, you know, this is all these cliches about L.A. being apocalyptic, you know? Like, apocalypse is always happening in L.A. Everything's always on fire. Cops are always killing people. And it's like so corny. It's in like so many films, so many novels. It's just, and you know, the Santa Anas are blowing right now. It's 70 miles an hour, you know, but it's sometimes it's actually true. Everything is just hell.
Right.
Like I remember I was teaching Tropic of Orange, this novel. It's very good, but it goes pretty hard on the LA as the site of the Armageddon. And I was like, I just remember being really annoyed at having to teach this shit, having to talk about this narrative at length. And I was like, I was taking the escalator up at the metro station on Hollywood and Highland, which is the worst intersection in America. And I remember like I was reading it while, you know, going up the escalator, and then I just got out there and like the whole block was locked off. It was like 100 degrees also, of course. The whole block was locked off because there was a terrorist threat at the fucking Hooters on the corner.
And that's, I was apocalyptic.
Like, God damn it. Like, I love L.A. I really fucking do. And I defend it constantly. But I was like, fuck. I mean, it was true-ish, you know? We are always on fire in one way or another.
Right. Well, it's also like, you know, next to Phoenix or Vegas, it's one of the most unsustainable, quote unquote, unsustainable places in the country. And,
right.
You know, but what makes it really unsustainable is that there's so many fucking people moving and living there.
Yeah. Also, what makes it unsustainable is the fact that I like to – I get a lot of my reading done, like, in the shower. So I take, like, half an hour showers. And even when I get out, I leave the shower running because I just love the sound, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm terrified of silence. So I'll just leave it on for, like, 5 minutes while I get ready.
Huh. How do you read? I mean, I like reading in the bath, I've never heard of reading in the shower.
Oh, man. It's amazing. It's just like, you know, a really peaceful, quiet place with good white noise and a little steam. It's good. People don't believe me until I show them, like, the ink marks all over the walls from the newspaper. Well, I'm like, no, this is for real. I've been in this game for, like, 20 years. Like, I innovated this shit.
That's funny. Well, the other thing is I don't like taking hot showers when it's warm out, and since it's usually warm. I mean, I don't like taking baths when it's warm out.
Baths are disgusting. Yeah.
But it only makes sense when it's cool. Like, I'll try that next time. I'll take a book into the shower.
Yeah. So, it's good. It's good to have, like, one book that you always read in the shower. So you get excited for showers because you want to get back to this one book.
I mean, you know, I'm reading Margaret Atwood in the bath right now, and I'm loving it.
Okay.
What's your shower reading right now?
I'm reading this anthology of gay plays called Gay Plays, Volume 2.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, before we, you know, just talk about our cleaning, whatever.
Our hygiene rituals.
Let's talk about, I don't want to talk about you, you know, because you don't want to.
Because who am I?
Yeah. So you have a new album out called Un-Indian. It's basically like a Beatles reunion album. You got all the gang back together for one last party, but you haven't put out an album for 13 years.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even really want to do an album. It just, like, happened to be like 40 minutes of music that kind of just fell together at the last minute. You know, I did the one album, you know, and I had, like, another album called Songs of Light Workers Local. It was kind of a collection. But I don't like albums. I don't trust albums. I don't trust people who make albums. Like I skip through albums and try to find, like, one song that really sings. And the rest, I just don't trust you, you know?
Right. Is that why you – but why haven't you put on – like, what's – like on, I mean, the real –
I've done a lot of I've done a lot of other stuff, as you know, on other people's albums. Like, I've written for people and done a verse here and there. That's just more interesting to me. Like, I don't need, like, some definitive thing, you know? It's just not – it just doesn't feel like me.
Right. But I'm interested in that specifically. So, like, you put out your last album in, what, 2005? Is that when it came out?
Yeah, something like that.
And, you know, just from between now and then, like, you don't have a pedestrian Twitter account. You never gave a fuck about any of that shit.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, I'd like to hear your take on that. Like, you've always spelled your name with a lowercase, you know, like.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's always been central to, like, my art. This idea that I'm not really a particular self. And, you know, I've never done music videos or t-shirts or anything. Like, I just found it fundamentally strange to pretend that I'm a brand for the sake of some sales, to pretend that I'm anything that you could buy or commodify. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's the concept of Un-Indian. You know, it's a poetic concept, but it's really about this fundamental lack of self, or a way in which this particular self is centered on absence, you know?
What do you mean by absence?
Well, I mean, you know, I've taught race for many years, and I've taught the concept of white privilege, and it's useful for 19-year-olds to think about. But it's always seemed, like, absurd to me. Like, laughably small in scale, given the givens. And the givens, to be, like, a straight white male American, is for your entire existence to be predicated on loss, on murder, on human bondage. And so, you know, a part of the pedestrian thing is, like, I've never wanted to sound like one person, you know? I've wanted to sound different on every single song. I wanted to be unrecognizable, as anonymous as possible, while asserting myself. And also, you know, that comes with a responsibility to understand that white privilege makes that possible. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's deep, man. That's awesome. Not to say deep, but for some reason, as you were saying that, I was just, because I don't know, like, you know, we've been friends for a little while now, and you know, when we first started doing shit, you called yourself Cosmic Love Fuck, and that was like
that was just for one verse. Yeah, right? I mean, you know, I was doing music journalism too, and I used a different name every single fucking time. Like, I just love that idea that I can be a thousand different selves. Or none at all, because I don't really feel like a whole person, you know. But I'm, you know, aware that, like, what that means in terms of, you know, our Americanness. And so the Young Indian thing is like this poetic concept that requires us to recall that half the streets we walk on in California are named after war criminals. Like, the stakes are extremely high all the time.
Or they're named after, you know, Native American tribes out here. They're all named after.
Which is something I talked about in an old song, Lifelong Liquidation Sale. It was largely about that, how Native names remain.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, okay, so let's talk about you a little bit, not too much, though. So when we were all, you know, when the early Anacon stuff was happening and we were all branding ourselves and commodifying our existences, you were like, fuck that, and, you know, started going to Laney College.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of pursued an academic. So can you talk about that, like, your academic path and like what you've been doing?
Yeah. I mean, by the way, you've always told the story of the naming of Anticon incorrectly, as has everyone. Like, y'all all got this shit wrong. You like to say it was anti-commodification, which was not fucking true. The name comes from, I was obsessed with Dada at the time. I was like a high school dropout, 19. Like, not uncommon, you know? Not an uncommon obsession. But so there was always an argument about, like, the origin of the term Dada. And it was generally considered, like, Dada was kind of a pan-European, like, yes, yes. You know, it just means it's kind of yes.
Oh, okay.
But there was also a counter-argument that it meant no, that it meant rejection. Because in some European languages, that's what Dada means. Pairing together anti and con was like a no to me. It was a rejection, you know? And it paired with my politics, and I just wanted to burn everything down. It was like a fuck you, you know?
Right.
So anyway, yeah, I went to
Berkeley. But you came up with the name. Like, a lot of people say other people did, but, you know, just for the record.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You picked it out of a list of much shittier names.
Like, what was the other one?
My other favorite one that would have been so embarrassing was, it was from an Emily Dickinson poem. It was Mortal Lip Divine.
Yes!
Again, man, like, I'm just a pretentious motherfucker, which is, well, I try not to talk too much anymore. Because it just comes out. Like, I was doing some press shit with the Alpha Pup dude, and he asked me some question. I don't remember what it was, But I did one of my things where I was like, you know, dialoguing with the dead in this art and blah, blah, blah. I rambled for a second. And then at the end, I was like, and fuck money.
Right.
Like, for no reason. Like, why the fuck would I say that? Like, did I think I found, like, the three words that, like, cast the spell that abolished capitalism? Like, I just can't help myself. I'm just annoying like that. Like, fuck money. Like, nobody asked. Like, I'm also the brokest person I know, generally. Like, always have been. So, why, you know, definitely do not trust me about money. Like, but I cannot help myself.
But, and he ends up putting that in the bio as well. So.
Yeah, yeah. Which is hilarious. I've given a staged reading of a couple of those answers for friends who like to laugh at me.
That's awesome. Yeah. But so you chose your own path. You went to Laney College. You know, can you talk about your academic career and some of that, some of the stuff you studied that you geeked out?
Yeah, I went to Laney for 3.5 years. Laney is like a blessed community college in Oakland, beloved Oakland. So 3.5 years there because we were doing Anacon and I was working. And I'm slow at everything. And then I transferred to Berkeley because we have an amazing public education system here. And I did English with a post-colonial studies emphasis. And then I did a PhD program in ethnic studies for 8 years at USC.
Nice. And you, but you never, you never got your PhD, right?
I quit.
It's like right at the right when you're about to get it, you're like, "Yeah, fuck it."
Yeah, well, I mean, I knew I didn't want to be in that world anymore, and I, you know, because I started later. Like a bunch of my friends had been on the job market and had been through that process for years already, and so I saw it close hand, and it was just ugly, man. It was just, you know, especially after the recession, departments like ethnic studies or American studies were just cut. Immediately, because, you know, disaster capitalism. And so, you know, I have friends that were, you know, did all the things that I didn't really do, which was publish constantly and do the conference thing and network, and, you know, be like mature people and do their thing. And they were applying for jobs that had literally 1,000 other applicants. And they were shitty jobs in Iowa.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so it also the past 10 years, academic labor has been largely performed by graduate students and adjunct labor, which is pretty much migrant labor. You cobble one class here, another class there. You might be commuting 20 hours a week, and you're getting paid shit. And it's completely unstable, semester by semester. So, like, the shit wasn't pretty, man. Like, there's this aura around the idea of a PhD, but it's the aura that you actually, that's your compensation, like not actual monetary compensation or job stability, you know, it's just the aura. And so like you get in the trenches for long enough and you see how unromantic it is. And it's a fucking dead end for almost everyone.
Damn. I know. Cause I always look at professor, like that's like the one thing that's the other, like, you know, that's always like the big what if in the back of my head. Like,
right.
Like, that's the thing I could have done, you know?
Right.
Or that's like the only other thing I would be willing to do, basically.
Right.
Because it seems like this life of leisure and joy.
Yeah. It's really dark, man. It's really bad. You know, only like, I don't know, at this point, 15, 20% of professors are tenured. And, you know, even tenure isn't really shit. They can retract your tenure at any fucking time. You have to write a book every 2 years or you're under threat. So, I mean, it's just really unstable labor and it's poorly compensated in general. And it's kind of shit work.
That sucks. Yeah, I mean, you're not the only, believe it or not, Brandon, you're not the only person that has said this.
Yeah, no. I mean, yeah, it's a conversation I've been having for 10 years with friends, you know? So, yeah, I mean, I definitely wonder, like, why I wasted nearly a decade. I didn't really think about it. I kind of just, like, we got back from tour in, like, 2005 or something. And I lived off that money for like 6 months. And I remember I was working on one song that entire time. It was called Song of Saint Pac. It was about like the folk legend of Tupac. And, you know, I did like months of research into medieval saints' tales and trying to understand like what folk saints were exactly and how that worked. And after 6 months, like the money ran out. I did not even record the song. I really wasted that entire time. And I was just broke as fuck. And Tia had just moved to Bangladesh. So I was like, I'm clearly not going to make a career out of music. You know, like, it's fucking so obvious. 6 months of research for one song I never did. You know?
That's awesome.
And it was like December in Oakland. And we got the fucking heat cut off. And I was just like dead broke. I was like, I have like very few skills on this particular plane. I will just apply to grad school, I guess, because I had some friends in grad school. So I just applied and I went to Bangladesh for 6 months and came back and started a fucking PhD program. So there was like no plan. I just didn't know what else to do because, you know, I'm not very qualified at life.
Well, that's good because life's, you know, I'd never want to grow up, man. I guess I'm having to grow up now a little more, but I'm kicking and screaming every inch of the way.
Your fatherhood?
Daddy.
Yeah, you're probably, I imagine you're like pretty classic father character.
I don't know. I'm... My kid likes
You're
me.
You're fucking straight,
he likes me.
And you have a wife and a child who likes you, apparently.
Yeah, so he likes me. So, I mean, that puts me ahead of most dads. Most smart kids hate their father, so.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I always imagined myself, like, in a lesbian commune,
well,
you know?
Aren't you?
That's what I thought. No. Married to a woman, and we live in El Sereno. On the east side, alone. But no, I always thought I didn't imagine that I would end up like this normal. I always saw myself like in a 1975 lesbian commune, like the only dude, you know, special.
Well, it's not over, you know.
Well, it's kind of over. I don't know, man. There's a disappointment. I thought there would be like a different, more radical future for me. I thought of it vaguely, but I just imagined that would be true. I didn't. So, like, yeah, I don't know, man. We're talking kids, but I don't know if I can do it. Like, if not outside of a commune, you know. I wanted to be in a cult, but I just didn't believe in anything.
Right.
So I was just kind of in a communist cult, which like did it for me a little bit. But
what communist cult?
Philly Refuse and Resist.
That was a communist cult.
It did not refuse and resist did not start out that way, but I think I'm not entirely sure of the story, but I think in the 90s they were infiltrated. I don't recall the term that like the Trotskyists use, but it's like when you join other organizations and gradually take them over.
Social insertion?
No, it's a different term. It's like very specific to mid-century communist movements.
Is it entryism?
Entryism, exactly.
See, trust me, us anarchists know all the bad things communists have done.
Entryism is like so fucking foul. Like if you just lie and cheat and try to seize power, what the fuck is the point of the whole of struggle, you know? But anyway, so I think they were kind of taken over by like the RCP and maybe the World Workers Party. They were taken over by some like culty motherfuckers. And so, yeah, it became different. Philly Refuse and Resist was like solely focused on Mumia Abu-Jamal at that time.
Well, okay. I mean, that's definitely on my list of things to talk to you about. So let's just go there. You know, you, when I knew you from, like, you know, we met online on message boards, like rapping and trading tapes and shit.
You were selling your tape and I never paid you for it still.
Oh yeah. You ripped me off.
Mad skills and unpaid bills. Yeah. I did not pay your bill.
That's, but
my bill,
you know, you could say you paid your dividends down the line. So,
okay. Good, good.
But
is that what you're calling me? You're trying to get you $5?
But so you, but you know, you were like a Free Mumia activist when you were like 50, you know, and you've always had radical politics. Like, I feel like, you know, Anticon Records, you know, it was your idea to have a collectively run label. You always had those radical politics, and I never really even learned a lot of this shit till much, much later in life.
Right.
So I guess I would like to.
That's one of the, like, the founding absurdities of Anticon, in that we are supposedly a collective, but there is very little, like, ideological investment or coherent commitment to collectivity, and hence the failure of the label in that way, in that essential ethical way. You know, we tried, but there just wasn't we weren't clear minded enough about it, and there weren't the political commitments to make it really happen.
Yeah, I mean, the big lesson I learned from that is anytime I do any project that involves collective decision making process or money, we always revisit everything we're doing every 6 months, or you know, we always leave it wide open to look at it again, like what's not working. You know, how are decisions being made you know, but.
And that's a commitment to, like, a lot of extra work. And that's a lot to ask for of 21-year-olds, most of whom didn't go to college, only one of whom went to college. And we're also trying to make art and, like, work at the same time, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, so I recall very clearly, and I've heard different versions of this in other podcasts, of how we came to be a collective. And I remember very clearly that you and Adam, who are more or less the leaders of Anticon, at least in the business sense and, like, the, you know, networking and charismatic sense, and Bailey, who was our business guy, were going to, because we were at a point where we had to, like, incorporate. It was like at that, it was, you know, it's time. And you guys were going to be the co-owners. And I was just like, I remember this for a very particular reason, but I was just so fucking pissed, and it was like a visceral thing. It just felt wrong, you know, and it totally made sense, and everyone trusted you guys. But I did one of my things. This is why I remember it. I did one of my things where I'm like, oh, it's like that. Like, all right, fuck all y'all. If we don't all own it, I want no part of this bullshit. You know, like, I do this thing sometimes where I, like, threaten to blow everything up and, like, leave forever. And it's like, it's embarrassing in memory. So because it's usually embarrassing in retrospect, like, I remember pretty much every single time I've done that.
Well, I don't think that was the wrong position to take.
Yeah, but that's kind of what I mean. Like, I didn't, you know, I wasn't an anarchist. Like, I wasn't really familiar with how to organize collectives or how they should be run. It was more visceral, you know? So we were never very, like, coherent in the way that we did things.
Right. Yeah, no, totally. I mean, a bunch of...
We were kids. Yeah, we were fucking kids.
You mean kids?
Like, dropouts and shit. Like, yeah.
But I actually really don't want to talk about that stuff, so...
Yeah, yeah,
You don't want... Mm-hmm. We don't want
to
go there.
But nothing to talk about, anyway. It's not that interesting.
But, like, so how... So you've always... I mean, it's... I've always kind of been fascinated by your politics, though, because, like, you know, you're obviously, you know, I guess you come from a communist background and you have, like, a critique of power, but you don't identify as a Marxist or a communist or anything, right?
No, I don't identify as anything. And I respect people who do, because that's a part of their practice, like their political practice. And it matters to identify and to, like, rep your shit. But I feel like if I'm not really out there organizing like that. And it started to feel at some point like a kind of a vanity to claim anything. You know what I mean? Like, right. I'm socialist, anarchist. Like, that's, like, my politics. We're democratic socialists. Like, I'm, you know. But, yeah, it felt vain at, you know, at some point. I mean, you're really out there organizing. And to call yourself an anarchist in the act of organizing matters. But if it's just, like, some pretense, I don't.
Yeah, like an identity.
Yeah, yeah. I believe in, like, the capital L left. Right. Like, whatever form that takes. Like, yeah, like, whether it's labor or whether it's feminist organizing, like, whatever it is, or burning shit down. Like, I'm just, like, a left dude.
Right. But, you know, you have a strong critique of, you know, power and capitalism and all that stuff. I know it's kind of a stupid question, but it's like, how did you get involved with fucking Philly Refuse and Resist when you were, like, 15 years old?
I was writing them letters, and they were mailing me Mumia's tapes. They were called Live. It was a series called Live from Death Row that later became a book. But I had just been obsessed with black militant politics in the U.S. in general. I think a part of it for me was, like, coming from rap, of course. And also, you know, I moved from Southern Virginia to Chula Vista, which is 2 miles from the border in Southern California, when I was 13. And it was like an overnight move, like, to a different family. And so, like literally overnight, like, everything changed in my life. And so that allowed a possibility of, you know, reinventing myself at a time when we're, like, trying to figure out what we could be, you know, just turned 13. And it was, like, traumatic, but then I fell in love with Southern California really quickly. And also came to resent how I lived before, came to resent the church that I grew up in. My sister became a queer Quaker pastor, and she's cool. And the church wasn't that bad. But I came to resent all this shit. And most of all, I hated the fact that I actually grew up in an apartheid state and didn't know. You know, everything was normalized. So, like, it didn't feel like apartheid. It was just, that was, like, the natural order of things. And there was just so much, just the weight of so much history in every moment where I grew up. And then I moved to Chula Vista and, you know, it was so different. It was so far from the binaristic black and white of the South, you know, and it was invigorating, man. It was a jolt. And it was not perfect. Like, you know, in Chula, we lived in this condo complex, and all the kids my age, we used to play this game where, like, you know, ICE was a constant presence. So, like, every night there were ICE helicopters out with spotlights searching for immigrants. And we used to play this game where, like, like one person would, like, run in the spotlight. And then, like, someone would have, like, a watch and, like, time it and see how long you get the spotlight to follow us. And we'd run all over. It was like a desert. So we would just, like, you know, try to set new records on ICE fucking helicopter following us. So, like, shit was dark. Like, it was not – it was a different kind of apartheid state. But just in terms of thinking about race and power and, the, you know, the meaning of race – It was a jolt, man. And so, you know, I was a rap dude too. And so, yeah, just that's how, like, I started thinking about race and started thinking about where I'd come from and what kind of world this is and what the fuck is America. And so my politics haven't really changed since I was 15. I hope they've deepened, but they're pretty much the fucking same. I'm still pissed. Like, fuck this world.
When a young man, I sang under street lamps, freestyled for dear life, my chest a bass amp. The vein of one moment I can trace even now, the conch shell crowd, the noxious cloud of weed-soured breath, the windshield glass on which my face flashed and stretched. As a key carries the hand that turns it, so a vision I trail down the lines of this verse itself in transit after voices double-crossed by time. Lord knows, we were as poor then as the frozen plains on a quarter moon. And though I'm still broke in all but days, the song has changed, and none too soon. At 17, see, I truly believed in revolution to come, that mythical beast of 7 tangled heads, none of which agree, and 7 hard hearts, not one what they seem. How could I know then those dreams were serving life sentences with the men who dreamt them, and all those dimmed by prison, George Jackson, Saint Bumia, of an ever forthcoming end. And who knows now what lays low in stale rooms of the skull, where spliff smoke blows, and the 3 AMs of late 30-year-olds embolden ash, old, and alien.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, I'm glad I asked that question. I mean, it sounds like such a corny ass interview question, but then right. It's like, damn, like to move from white ass, or you lived in
white, white and black. It was 50-50, you know?
Right.
But I just, yeah, I felt lied to, man. Like I grew up in segregation, you know, and I didn't suffer from it except like part of my humanity was absent.
Right. Well, on the racial tip, this is something you and I have discussed, but if you have anything to throw out there on this, I'd be interested to see. You know, all these writers over the years have written about Anticon and whiteness, and mm-hmm. I feel like none of it really captured what was going on there. And no. I just wonder if you have anything to add or any comment on like the, you know, what people missed about race and early indie hip hop movement.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's not a good question.
Yeah, it's just it's just hard to put the weight of history on a bunch of kids making art,
right.
And people did project that onto us. We just got called all manner of things by like recent college graduates who had shitty gigs writing. And, you know, that was a funny thing to me is that they would constantly call us like grad school poets. You know, we were like 22-year-old dropouts.
Right.
Like high school dropouts. Like, we're just being slurred as these like, they were projecting onto us some other shit. And actually, like a major problem of those critical failures, was like missed opportunities to go deeper. And we were definitely, we were worth critiquing or thinking about. Like we were not above fault. Like the face of Anticon was pretty fucking white, and we were doing a black art, and I still am, you know. Like, I didn't feel personally implicated in those critiques, but I get it. They could have been better.
The critiques could have been better.
Yeah. And we could have been better in a lot of ways.
Totally. I often think about, like, I did an interview recently where I was talking about music for the, like, we made a fucking record called Music for the Advancement of Hip Hop. And yeah. I was just saying, like, man, I wish we had mentors back in the day, because if there was an older cat in the room, they would have slapped the shit out of us. They're like, no, back to the drawing board.
That was on me. And that was, I mean, so that's a good instance of the way in which we were frequently misinterpreted. Like, that shit was on me. Like, that pretentious-ass title. But, you know, like, rap is pretentious and assertive in that way. But also for me, it was like my aesthetic tradition comes out of South LA from Good Life, Project Blode. Like, that was my obsession. I was absolutely fixated on the idea that rap had a fucking straight up, honest to God, avant-garde culture out of South LA in the late 20th century. Like, it was the most, to me, that was the most important aesthetic movement in late 20th century America. To a larger point, I don't know if this matters to anyone ever, but, you know, when we started our shit, I imagined us as being in dialogue with Good Life Project Blood. You know, this avant-garde thing that came out of South L.A. in the early 90s and was just, to me, the most remarkable thing. You know, when I first heard Fellowship, Freestyle Fellowship, I was like, oh, this is what people mean when they talk about art. Because, you know, I come from, like, low, middle-brow people. I don't really think about art in that way. And, like, there was this music that was so dazzling and inventive and exploratory. And it came out of Crenshaw and Exposition. And I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that, you know, these aesthetic possibilities were available to me. And I had already decided, like, rap was the only thing, the only art I could ever really pursue. You know, it was just like, you know, the voice that I had to speak through. And that was what was accessible to us, being of a certain age and inclination. And so when I heard this music, it changed my life. Like, art that I encountered after that, I filtered it through what I learned from A Good Life and Project Blood. So when we were doing Anacon, like, I mean, I kept thinking when I learned about Dada when we were starting Anacon, and I was obsessed with that. I kept thinking, like, you know, we had a Cabaret Voltaire, which was like the Dada spot. We had one, and it was called The Good Life, and then it was called Project Blow, Chaos Network. Like, we had that, like, in our generation, and they were speaking our language. And so when we did Anacon, that's what I wanted to be in dialogue with those cats, the older cats who did that, who introduced art to, like, a lot of people, especially on the West Coast. And to me, it was an assertion of West Coast aesthetics in particular. Like, there was New York had become very stifling at that point. It had become very self-referential and rigorous in policing other ways to rap or to think about rap or to make songs that had rap at its core but didn't necessarily sound like rap. And I rejected that shit. I was on some fuck New York shit. And that's what that title meant to me. It was like, no, this is West Coast avant-garde shit. You know, it's Black tradition. That's where we came from. I didn't really think about it, like, in terms of how it would be perceived by critics.
Right.
Because, again, I was just on some blow the world up type shit. I didn't care. Like, I still don't care. I've still never been embarrassed by that title. As embarrassed as everyone else is who's associated with it.
I'm not embarrassed. Like, I'm not embarrassed by it. I just see it differently now, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I, you know, how would I have known, like, how others would really perceive it? I mean, I was just on some, like, this is fucking West Coast avant-garde shit. You know, there's different politics out here. There's a different set of aesthetics, set of possibilities. You know, there's not the burden of fucking Kumo D hanging over our heads. Like, fuck all that shit. Like, I don't need it.
Well,
like, if you're really gonna ride for something, like, do it full tilt. You know what I mean?
Or ride for something dope. I mean, I remember. I mean, like, you know, when you heard a song on, like, some song I made in '94, it was like, the West Coast is whack, and Miami bass was whacker. Yeah. And then you were like, nah, homie, you need to check this shit out. And so you sent me all these tapes of, like, Fellowship, you know, even, like, I think it was, like, Homeless Derelicts. Can you hear me? And you sent me all this crazy West Coast underground shit. And today, you know, I feel like that era of hit, that specific era of, like, Project Blowed, are you there? I feel like not a lot of people know about Project Blowed. So can you talk about, like, the Good Life a little bit and, like, going to it and, like, what was going on that made that shit so powerful for you?
Yeah. I was in, like, 10th or 11th grade, me and my homies, Gabe, who did art for you back in the day, Live Poets, he drew a clown with two Krylon cans.
I found that. I'm looking at it right now.
Are you serious?
Yes.
I kicked it with Gabe like 2 months ago, man.
That's awesome.
Yeah, but me and Gabe and my homie Benny stole Benny's older brother's car. And on one Thursday night, and like it was 95 or 94 maybe, we road trip to LA, like three fucking 15-year-olds. None of us had like permits or anything. But they had just moved to the Blode, and the Blode started later than the Good Life. So we missed them by like a month. So that was my only time with the Good Life. But yeah, it was, you know, the Good Life and Project Blode was this improvised community of artists, like from the hood. And it was mostly black and in direct descent from the black arts movement in Los Angeles of the mid, late 60s and black nationalist political traditions in the 80s that emerged after, you know, the murder of black Marxist and secular militant movements. It came out of like this very Pan-African space called the Good Life. But it was also Latino and Asian American, and it was filled with women making art. And these cats, they were so young, and they just invented this whole new way of doing rap. It was like they invented an entirely different art. It was like the South Bronx in the late 70s. But these cats were like jazz inflected. Even the gangsters were rapping like jazz dudes. Like, and it was tied to the community very deeply in like some of the most important traditions in the history of Los Angeles over the last 150 years. Like, this shit was so profound and so open and messy and exploratory. And I mean, I still don't think that music historians or listeners in general have really reckoned with how magical that thing was, that particular movement. And part of it's because, you know, it wasn't easy to record in bedrooms at the time, not well. And there were a bunch of major record deals from those cats, but they quickly dissipated because they weren't so commercial, because they didn't fit a common expectation of black men making art in general, you know? But I still don't think that we've adequately appreciated what was happening there.
Did you ever watch the This Is the Good Life documentary?
Oh, yeah, of course. A bunch of times.
I still haven't seen it.
Yeah, you know who directed it, right?
The woman who did Selma, right?
Eve. That was her rapper name. Yeah, I mean, it's a terrible documentary, but it's like a really important document. I just can't believe, like, I mean, it's terrible. It's a terrible documentary. And I can't believe she, like, went on to become a really polished, excellent filmmaker, like, pretty much right away after that documentary.
But
that's what's so interesting to me. She was obviously so ambitious and connected and, you know, learned around film. She went to UCLA, which has a very well-known tradition of producing African-American filmmakers from LA. She felt this was like the thing that needed to be expressed first. Like, her first thing had to be this. She didn't make any money off it. She spent years on it. But it had to be that, because people just did not fucking know. And it just, if you actually really absorb what happened there and then I think your experience of rap and of late 20th century art in the United States and African-American culture all change radically. You really have to, like, absorb the meaning of that movement. Otherwise, you don't know the whole picture. You know, you have a warped view. So when we did Anacon, like, I wanted to extend and dialogue with that movement because I thought it was the most important thing. And so I still ride for it. It's not like I sit around listening to all that shit anymore. I've spent my time doing that. But I still ride for that hell hard.
Yeah. I mean, I can say I became friends with, Micah, and, we had, mm-hmm. we ended up developing relationships with a lot of those people, but it just takes, it takes time, to, mm-hmm. to build friendships and shit.
Totally.
So so in one of my recent interviews, we were talking about Banks of Marble, and I was talking about the idea of the detourned maw or detournment mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. and how it's popularized by the situationists. But, it's actually, when you think about it from a music perspective, the history of folk music, and is nothing but that, and that's something you've geeked out on a lot of your life is
Pete Seeger described it as the folk process, right? The process by which things are, words and melodies are taken up generation after generation and molded by many hands over hundreds of years and added to and carried on without any sacred commitment to something, some magical originality, or a faithfulness to some imagined original form. And because that's how working people collaborate. That's how working class people collaborate with each other over fucking centuries. And it can be dark and cold and hard. It's not, it's not a fucking hymnal, this set of songs. And that idea fascinated me. I became obsessed with early 20th century American music a long time ago, and partially because it spoke rap aesthetics to me. There's a primacy of voice, a concern for words, for phrasing, a distaste for sentiment, cheap sentiment. There's a lot of death. And people stole from each other. And that's what rap is, thoughtful theft. So pretty much every song I do is informed by older songs. And not all Appalachian ballads. Some are bastardizations of music hall songs from the turn of the century, But I think if you really care about working class culture, and if you care about art in general, it's not tidy and was not born to be commercial, wasn't made for the sake of touring for the next year, then you really have to care about that, and you have to dig for it sometimes.
That's one of the things that's novel about your new album, An Indian Too, is that even though it has your name on the record, there's tracks where you're not really even you're not even rapping on Resurrection Morning or the other shit where you have that dude singing, it's
my man Bobby. I think if you believe in the flow of art without an investment in property or of being the face of something or pretending that you originated it because you're brilliant, then you don't fucking care about, you don't care about being there. You care about collaborating and making something that's maybe beautiful and passing it on, but it's not really about you.
Right. If you have that mindset.
Yeah. It's hard to have. I mean, you can't have a reasonable expectation of a career if that's your fucking style. But I never did, so.
That's awesome.
So I have there's a liberation in not giving a fuck and a poverty to it as well. And a loneliness.
Well, but, hey, look, man, even if you are, concerned with putting your name on it and not giving a fuck, there's still a, a poverty and loneliness to it, trust me.
totally. Yeah, but yeah. I mean, there's there's a ideological and aesthetic significance to not giving a fuck. It's a way to look at the world. You know, you give a fuck about people and fucking art or whatever, but not giving a fuck about yourself, you know, and it could lead to me smoking, chain smoking Newport Hundreds right now. there can be a self-destructiveness that goes along with it, but fuck it.
You know, it's so funny because so many, I often say, I don't give a fuck. You know, like,
yeah, you do give a fuck though.
Right. But especially like when I do give a fuck, you know, I'll be like, whatever, I don't give a fuck. And I'm like trying to convince myself, like, I don't give a fuck.
Totally.
It's like wishful thinking.
Yeah. Or like someone like, you know, people, when sometimes men fight, they get themselves amped up first. They have to like bark for a minute before their like temper boils. And it's like that, like girding for a fight or something. And you don't necessarily believe what the fuck you're barking. It's a weird, I mean, yeah, not giving a fuck is just a strange, it's so strange to have a commitment to that phrase, because what is that phrase even?
Yeah.
Like, it's impossible to not give a fuck. Like, you wake up, you know, you go to bed, you give a fuck, but
yeah,
it's a stance.
I mean, but it just sounds better than walking around saying, I refuse to live a life of bland mediocrity and subservience.
Yeah, I will not live on my knees. it's a rap way of saying it, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, shit.
Rap gives us a lot of those good euphemisms for resistance.
Long live Ice Cube.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I mean, one thing I'll say just before we move on to the next question and then the wrap up questions is that, like, you know, this whole, your ideas about folk music and, you know, you instantly like put that shit on rap and we're making those connections in like 2005 and sharing that with me. And it really deeply, you know, impacted me, you know, to the point where I started making those Nuclear Winter mixtapes. With those ideas and so, you know, thank you.
I just can't imagine how people can make music without caring about that shit. It's not nostalgia. That shit's still alive. It's not like history is over, and, you know, like we're part of this. We share the same fucking land, the same air as those cats. That shit was like yesterday. So to pretend that like that was some from magical past is just so absurd.
For real.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, especially now, you know, a minute is a week and a week is a year. The internet and shit.
Right.
Well, so this is something you were saying to me the other day, and you were kind of phrasing it in a way that I hadn't really heard anybody else talking about it. And this is this, you know, like under Trump, all these like Russell Simmons and all these powerful men going down, and like the way you were talking about it sort of like evoked the Arab Spring or something. It's like the Arab Spring of like toxic men shit. Like,
I think it's remarkable. Yeah, no, I mean, I've been having this conversation a lot, obviously. And some of my friends, you know, like gender study professor types are like, oh, you know, like, why are you surprised? Like, of course this has been happening. And that's a fair point. Because we all knew it was happening, right? But I keep thinking of, like, when the Catholic Church shit broke 15 years ago or so. Like, my thought on it was, like, yeah, okay, we knew it was happening. But now we really know. And, oh, my God, like, of course, virgin priests running fiefdoms in Europe and the U.S., you know, in the relative absence of state power, were sexually abusing people since the church started. This has been happening for a millennia or two. It's been happening since the fucking Bible was assembled. The people that died of worms were going home and fucking abusing children and other people. You know what I mean? Like, that sudden knowledge, that break in what we know and are comfortable with is so remarkable. Like, this is actually, like, feminist resistance. It's collective feminist resistance, and it's profound, and it's toppling the major media figures in our particular world. And, you know, even if it's just Garrison Keillor groping a woman's back, even if it's that small, like, he still fell. Like, Tavis Smiley fell yesterday. Like, these dudes are falling, and there's a break in history. It was unexpected, and it happened through collective action. And even if we're just talking about, like, newsrooms and shit like that, and culture industry shit, that is profound.
Yeah. Do you think that, like, when you look at, like, I've found the last year to be depressing and disempowering personally.
Yeah. So that's the dynamic in which this happened, right? Like, a serial sexual predator was elected, and then this started happening because this is a moment of resistance to that in particular.
Right. Do you have hope? Do you think things are gonna, like, when you look at the next 5 years, like, what, you know, I mean, obviously you can't make predictions, but, like, you know, do you see it, like,
no,
I see things getting worse, actually.
Yeah. You mean in terms of,
like, outside of, like, this,
right,
the Arab Spring of Man, like, I'm talking about.
Right, right. No, but I mean, that's related in that. I think that, I mean, the Arab Spring of Man falling it topples men, but it doesn't, like, replace them necessarily. It's more destructive than productive, probably. And that's probably the fact of our world. And so, yeah, you know, cats will fall in the Russian investigation, but there's satisfaction in that. There's, like, some faint justice, and we can carry on the idea that justice is possible, and that's important. That's resistance. But no, I don't think resistance isn't enough, obviously, but it's a relief. That's what we have. I don't know. I've always been fatalistic. Like, we live in the height of an empire, like a racist imperialist state, and vulnerable people here and abroad will be affected. And I don't know if it topples. All I know is, like, there's, like, soulfulness and struggle.
This is a question I got off the internet, and it's if anything, it's just more funny. I know Pedestrian's a scholar, so what would you recommend majoring in college during the end times?
During the end times.
During right now is what this person.
Yeah, meant. Yeah. I don't know. I can't answer that.
I'll answer it. Learn how to dig trenches. Learn how to dig graves and sewers.
That's not a major. Yeah. Yes. Study to be go to grave digger school. Go to grave digger DeVry. Because as they say in California, prison guards and grave diggers stay paid.
So recently our friend DJ Steph passed away. Steph was, you know, the person who booked, you know, my first show in the Bay, and, you know, without her, I don't think we would have moved there. Of course,
neither of us had been.
Yeah.
And we fell in love with it when she brought us up there, and she housed us for a week with Rasta Q-Tip and DJ Surge and introduced us to everyone, because that's what she did constantly. And so I helped Peter throw the celebration a little bit. We had a celebration for her life at the Elbow Room, and I went up for the memorial too. So I've just been thinking about her a lot since she passed. She passed suddenly in her sleep. And her husband is the homie, and they met at an Anacon thing, I think, or Scribble Jam. But they met on the Anacon message board. And so, like, we're involved in their lives, you know, in some, like, profound, long way. You know, it's been, like, what, 20 years since we met Steph? And
yeah.
Longer,
actually.
Really? Yeah. I keep thinking about her in terms of, I've been thinking about her lately as a community organizer more than a DJ. And she was a really well-known DJ in the Bay for 30-some years. And that's remarkable in itself, in that she was a female DJ in the mid-'80s in the Bay doing rap. And that wasn't heard of. You know, I just keep trying to imagine the depth of her patience for annoying men, and like just her love for the art, but her, like, I don't know how she tolerated all these goddamn men and did it so gracefully and lovingly, and, you know, brought people together in a really basic way. Like, she really made families happen, you know, like chosen families all over the Bay. And it's just, I don't know how those kinds of people exist. And I regret not asking more about, like, the, you know, the small details of how she made that happen, how she made a life. I mean, I think for us, I don't know if it's true for you, but when we were like 21 or something, 20, when she brought us up there, and we didn't know older people in hip hop. We didn't know that there was a possibility for a life in this music, because it didn't seem like there was. There weren't models for it, especially graceful ones. There were like some desperate, like grimy, old school types who like clung on and had like a pretty narrow aesthetic about, you know, how it should be done. But she was like a boom bap person, and she loved our shit. And like, I've never met anyone like her, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I think the thing that really, like, the big lesson and takeaway for me is, like, I personally, like, I've been to the Bay a number of times over the last, you know, 20 years or since I moved out of the Bay. But, like, you know, I never, like, called her up and was like, hey, let's go hang out. Let's go, you know.
Yeah.
And like, you know, we casually interact on social media and, like each other's stuff and tweet things at each other. But, like, you know, that's not, you know, and then you just take that shit for granted. And then you wake up and then then she's gone. And I'm like, fuck, holy shit, this person had such a huge impact on my life. And I don't even know if I'd be doing what I'm doing now if this person hadn't, like, put together a fucking newsletter called Vinyl Exchange in, like, 1996 and, like, wrote about music from all over the country. And, like, and it's just, and you realize I realize all this shit way too late. And it's beautiful to appreciate it and to acknowledge it. But it's also, like, the lesson for me is to, you know, to be a better person to the people that are supposed to matter to us, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I would holler at her and Surge when I was up there, but I also took for granted that she would just be around forever. There's something about her presence that just suggested stability and a possibility of life and loving this music and being a part of it. But I mean, what I really regret is just not, she had so much history. There was so much history of empathy and emotional commitment to what was a marginal music and what is an insurgent music still. My shit cut. My shit just keeps cutting out.
That's fine, man. And if people want to check you out on, if people want to check you out online and follow your work, what's the best way?
Yeah, right.
Down the martyred avenues of the O, we ghost rode a manic procession of holy fools who holler as they roll. Run, come see a movable Jerusalem in whose ruins there is a volume bound in a running wound and stitched with the strands unspooling from sirens which widen as they spiral towards you. We've been living where things were hidden before you. Taking on the passing form of a high note, charred, cops call from the scorching star of an EMT at whose heel a stericycle cart clings, which, over parched blocks, carries the debris of beginnings and the discarded knuckles of meat of some 100 surgeries. I can see it now, the penal aisle of San Quentin, and how unmoved its foul rooms at what within transpires. final trial of crude hands, trained to heal yet hired to undo his regulation blues, remove his shoes one by one, a strange seduction to unlash his veins and slip a suit of ash over uniform chains, and at last to peel serenely from a man the misleading veil of a name, Williams Stanley. No widow wept, no crip cried Santo now, and no guard called off a dawn patrol along the morning vault's institutional white walls, while on 7th, the solemn tolling of last calls. Oh, the murder's home overlooking old Oakland. With impotent chance, we strained to pry you open. Speaking old words in timber of golden fronts, dentures of gods too far and long gone from us. Seagram testified from the eye of the siren. On the other side of midnight, there's nothing but hard times. A cop-crossed soul whose complaint goes on. His name alone is song from guilt grills sung.